You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Amy Eddings, sitting in for Leonard Lopate. In the 1940s and 50s, Cold War hawks used blacklists to identify communists and their sympathizers. This period generally brings to mind Senator Joseph McCarthy and the Hollywood Ten. But other lesser-known figures also exerted significant influence, specifically over the airwaves. In his richly researched book, A Shadow of Red, historian and freelance writer David Everett explores the blacklist in radio and television, and I'm pleased it brings him to the show today. Welcome to WNYC.
Well, thank you for having me here.
You say the broadcast blacklist is a story apart from the Hollywood blacklist, and one that's more crucial. Why?
Well, for one thing, it involved different people, and with the Hollywood blacklist, we had something that was imposed from above by congressional investigations. With the broadcast blacklist, it was really a grassroots phenomenon involving, most principally, five people who helped to impose a blacklist from below. And three of them were ex-FBI agents, one was a former naval intelligence officer, and one, incredibly enough, was a grocer from Syracuse. And also it involved a medium which I think reached more people, and also was a medium that involved the dissemination of information, which is something that's always something that people are concerned about what sort of information is getting out there, whether you're talking about people on the right or the left.
Before we talk about these five individuals, set the stage for us. What was happening in radio and television at the time? Television was newly emerging, radio pretty much established.
Yes, well, you know, radio had just gone through what was known as its golden age. TV was just coming in, and it was not a time when the network executives were real interested in tolerating a lot of controversy. They already had enough to deal with, which I think is one of the reasons why they were so quick to give in to the blacklisters.
Let's talk about those blacklisters. Who were the key individuals behind the broadcast blacklist?
Well, as I mentioned before, originally it was three ex-FBI agents, Theodore Kirkpatrick, John Keenan, and Kenneth Bierley, who had been FBI agents during World War II. They were in the so-called Communist Squad in New York City. They were not involved with Soviet espionage, but they were investigating infiltration of organizations, such as unions, to a great extent.
And their office was right in Foley Square, just a
That's
few blocks from here.
Right near here. And they were very frustrated because they saw a communist infiltration threat. And they didn't think much was being done about it. And there was, while they were in the FBI, they couldn't publicize the sort of things that they were finding. So they decided that they should get out of the FBI and then put together some sort of publication that would publicize what they think was the real danger that people were facing. And that's when they put together a newsletter called Counterattack, which would give you an idea of what sort of militant idea they had on this issue. And also, a couple of years later, what was really important is they published a booklet called Red Channels, which listed 151 suspected communist sympathizers. And this very quickly became what was known as the Blacklist Bible. The timing was, fortuitous for them, perhaps, depending on your point of view. Mm-hmm. It came out 3 days before people in the United States learned about the invasion of South Korea by North Korea. So suddenly, just as this booklet came out, the Cold War became quite hot.
Before we talk about those publications, a little more about these ex-FBI agents. So they had established careers, and they decided to give up those careers so they could do more to publicize the information that was at their fingertips, but they couldn't talk about. Did they all leave at the same time?
More or less at the same time, within around a year of one another. I think what this does point to is that they, contrary to what some people have tried to say, that they were really just mercenaries. I think this does point to the fact that they were more zealots than mercenaries, because they...
Explain the difference in your mind.
Well, they had other avenues for making money. Two of them were lawyers, and they had FBI experience, which is certainly something that looks good on the resume. There were other ways to make money. One of them was in a fairly large firm, downtown law firm. This was not the best way to go about making money, and I really think it was a matter, for the most part, although they did some things which were very questionable as far as pressuring certain people perhaps to subscribe to their newsletter or face the consequence of being written about in it. which was, certainly pretty unethical. But I think for the most part, they were doing it because they thought the ends justified the means.
Before we go further, I want to bring up a frame of reference for this discussion that you bring up in your book. You say we often see this period in our history in simplistic terms, and communists and their sympathizers as idealistic progressives, or as you put it, liberals with attitude. You think otherwise. Why is that?
Well, I would say when I first started working on this book, that was pretty close to how I looked at it based upon what I had read about it. But the more research I did, things looked a lot different to me. It wasn't, I think, a simplistic morality tale about the persecutors and the persecuted. And also what you tend to get, I think, in previous accounts is the idea that everyone or most everyone who was blacklisted was just someone who was left of center. And that's what the target was. I think there's more to it than that. I think that there was something going on, and certainly in broadcasting, based upon research that I did, there was a genuine effort by the Communist Party to get a foothold in that industry. I don't think they were on the verge of acquiring a stranglehold on the industry, as some suggested, but something was going on there. And there are a number of reasons for saying that, but I think ultimately what it is that I think you have to be naive to think that they wouldn't, because they were involved in other areas and gaining a foothold in various important unions, so there would be no reason why they wouldn't try to do something like this.
I'm Amy Eddings, sitting in today for Leonard Lopate, and I'm speaking with David Everett. He is the author of A Shadow of Red, Communism and the Blacklist in Radio and Television. Let's talk about Counterattack. What was its original purpose?
Well, it was to alert the public, well, to a great extent, businesses and also unions, to the communist presence in the business world and in the world of unions. They really weren't that concerned with entertainment at first. None of them were really attuned to that sort of thing. But they were all believed in the idea that there was infiltration in the communications industry. And after a year or so, they began to focus more on radio. Originally, it was on news commentators. And I think if they had really focused on that throughout their careers, I think things might have looked a little different, because at least you can make a case that a news commentator can broadcast propaganda of some kind. But once you start regulating entertainment shows, when you're deciding what sort of comedian should appear on a variety show, then it becomes a little more mysterious. And what actually the theory that they were going on was something that could best be described as the third violinist theory. Someone had once asked them, what possible harm could there be if there really was, say, a communist sympathizer who was the third violinist in a network studio orchestra? And the answer that they came up with is, well, he sits next to the first violinist. he knows perhaps someone in the control room, and he may know an announcer. He can have an influence. So what they were saying is that anyone who's in the studio or involved, you know, it can be a possible security problem. And once they started going down that road, things became a little different. And that's when they started to urge their readers. They weren't just pointing out who might be a communist. They were urging their readers to write to the networks and the sponsors protesting the presence of certain actors or directors and writers on shows.
Was this a magazine, newspaper?
It was
newsletter?
A newsletter.
Uh-huh. And how widely, who subscribed to it?
To a great extent was, I think, originally people in the business world and unions, but then it became much more common in the broadcast world as they started to focus on that, especially after Red Channels came out. And it became, I think, probably indispensable reading for a lot of people who wanted to make sure that they wouldn't get in trouble.
And these three ex-FBI agents, Keenan, Bierley, and Kirkpatrick, did any of them have writing experience or publishing experience?
Not really. One of them worked on, a law journal in college. So they had to bring in somebody who had some experience and also the same kind of point of view on this issue.
Now, you had mentioned that later they did some questionable things in terms of the pressure that they exerted on people to subscribe or be written about. But you also point out that they had some questionable methods in getting the information about communist infiltration and who was or wasn't involved in the Communist Party. Talk about that.
Well, there was, I think what you were referring to is the fact that it seems that they may have stolen documents from the FBI. And all of them concerned unions, which they sort of investigations that they had worked on. And it was a very troublesome thing for the FBI. There are all sorts of documents about that and trying to track down who exactly took them. And the FBI had no doubt who it was, although they didn't have any conclusive proof.
How did the FBI respond to this? Were they supportive in any way, thinking that these guys were onto something?
They might have been sympathetic to that basic idea, but they were outraged, principally because of this incident. And also, it seems J. Edgar Hoover wasn't too pleased about some of their, I guess you could call it, more strong-arm type of tactics. I think it's interesting that he objected to that as well.
What types of organizations did these three ex-agents single out in counterattack? You mentioned unions.
Yeah, well, the big focus is what was known as Communist Front organizations. That's really kind of a linchpin in the whole controversy. This is something that in a lot of accounts has been discounted. A lot of books, even when they mention the word Communist Front, will put it in quotes because they don't believe there was anything to it. What their interest in these things were, which were organizations that had basically liberal agendas. But there actually was more to it because, as was revealed in a Comintern Congress in 1935, the idea was to form these sorts of alliances with liberals to broaden their base and to use them, as this one speaker put it, as a Trojan horse. And the reason why these Red Hunters focused on it is because this was, as far as they were concerned, the tip of the iceberg for the communist movement. This was the part that was visible. And also it's true that what happened, I think as a result, whether this was planned or not, is that the communists who were involved in forming these organizations, they succeeded in blurring the line between communists and liberals and made the liberals more susceptible to the pressures that came later on. And they also distorted, I think, liberal ideas, because you have a group like the National Council on American-Soviet Friendship. Their idea was to promote peaceful coexistence, which is obviously a very respectable sort of
right,
idea.
Right, it's a very innocuous-sounding group.
Right away, that's what it seems like. But then what they would also do was encourage, or at least to demand the banning of certain movies. For instance, there was a movie called The Iron Curtain, which was based on the true story of a Soviet defector who exposed to a great extent the Soviet espionage network in the Western Hemisphere. And what they said is that this was actually a provocation. It was warmongering, which was all rather specious. It was obvious what the problem was that this movie and the incident that it was based on was a huge embarrassment to the Soviet Union and to the American Communist Party. So here they were taking this, an organization involved in peaceful coexistence, and turning it into an organization that was calling for censorship, which is not my idea of a liberal idea.
I'm Amy Eddings, sitting in for Leonard Lopate. I'm speaking with David Everett. He's the author of A Shadow of Red, Communism and the Blacklist in Radio and Television, published by Ivan R. D. We'll have more after a break. Stay with us. I'm Amy Eddings, sitting in for Leonard Lopate. Thanks for joining us. I'm speaking with David Everett about his book, A Shadow of Red, Communism and the Blacklist in Radio and Television. David, so we've heard about these three ex-FBI agents who do this newsletter, Counterattack. How did it, which was pretty broad-based in talking about communist infiltration in different groups and organizations. How did it get focused to just the broadcast industry through red channels? When did that switch occur?
Well, I think it happened gradually, but what really brought it about was, well, actually the publication of Red Channels and the sort of unexpected success it had. They had this was a supplement to Counterattack. They had published other supplements to Counterattack before that, which had some reasonable success, but this just took off to a great extent because of the timing of it, as we mentioned, because the Korean War started right after the publication came out.
And Red Channels was done by another gentleman involved in the group, Vince Harnett, right, who had worked in radio.
That's right. He had been a radio writer and also an assistant to a producer on a show called Gangbusters. He is the one who had been a naval intelligence officer during the war, and for him, what a turning point for him was he started to see reports at the end of the war about how the communists were taking over Romania through a combination of coercion and deception. He says this made a big impression on him, and he actually, while he left his job in radio because he had to, because he was creating a firestorm on the show, because he was orchestrating a letter writing campaign against a director of the show who he regarded as a communist. And the producer told him that either you stop this or you're going to have to quit. And he decided to quit. Once again, an indication of real zealotry.
Mm-hmm.
And he became involved in putting together Red Channels, and then became a consultant later on, what was called a talent consultant. He would write dossiers on various actors, writers, and directors. And he was hired to do this by sponsors or by advertising agencies or networks. And they would base their decisions on whether this person could work or not based upon the research he would do and what he would write about them.
And what kind of research would Harnett do?
Well, he was...
Was he accurate?
To a great extent, I think he was, as far as it went, because he was relying on public documents. Once again, to a great extent, it was about communist fronts, because that's what you could document.
Mm.
You couldn't document, really, a Communist Party membership, because that wasn't known. As far as it went, as far as saying that so-and-so was reported as being involved in this Communist Front activity, usually he wouldn't even say he was involved. He said, as reported in Daily Worker. It was, pretty accurate in that sense.
Mm.
The question is, what you do with the information. And
and what would get done with that information?
It would be used to keep certain people off the air.
How widely distributed was Red Channels? How popular was it as a reference or a resource?
Well, reportedly, every important office would have a copy of it, and perhaps would have a subscription to Counterattack. So, as I said, it became a broadcast Bible. A blacklist Bible. Excuse
me. How does that action happen? How is it that a network executive or a producer of a show get something in the mail and say, wow, I'd better refer to... what vetting process did they put Red Channels and Counterattack through?
Well, I think this is an important point, and this gets down to the role that the sponsors and the networks played in this, and which I don't think has been really emphasized enough. There, people who want to write about the communist influence in broadcasting, they have a right to do that, provided that they don't libel people. But what really gave them power was the fact that the sponsors and the networks caved into them so quickly. I think the only way to really describe it is it was a stampede instinct.
Mm.
As soon as there was trouble, they panicked, and they really didn't care who was trampled underneath. The first one to really do this was CBS, and they were the ones that instituted a loyalty oath and then a political screening process. And they went from being the most liberal network, which was also explains why they came under such scrutiny, to being the one that was the toughest as far as the blacklist was concerned. And I think it's a legitimate question whether they really had to do that, because there are instances of other people who would stand up to them. There was someone at ABC by the name of Robert Kintner. They had a show at the time, a quiz show hosted by Gypsy Rose Lee, the stripper turned author turned quiz show host. And there were charges that were sent to them from the American Legion. And his response, which I think is quite sensible, was to just fire back, well, give me the proof. Give
mm-hmm.
me the proof behind these allegations. Their response was, well, we don't have it. We just got this information from Red Channels. And then when they moved over to Red Channels, they said, well, this is just from public records. We can't give you anything more. It's not up to us. It's up to the public to decide this. So
and
each
one
passed the
ball. And would you rather be safe than sorry kind
yeah.
of feeling? Right.
And what happened was that Gypsy Rose Lee went on the air. There really wasn't anything they could do about it. And also, another part of it is that the blacklisters ended up looking quite foolish. And this is not the only instance of this. Mark Goodson, the famous quiz show producer, he found that he could stand up to these blacklist requests and he could get away with it.
Tell me how Red Channels affected a person's career. Give me an example.
Well, it could be quite severe. A famous example would be Philip Loeb, who had been on the show The Goldbergs. And he was an example of someone who was thoroughly blacklisted as far as radio and TV was concerned. He couldn't work in the medium after that. For the most part, I think most people would come into the category of gray-listed. They couldn't appear on certain shows, but other shows might have them. Certain directors would use them, others wouldn't.
Is that what happened with Jean Muir?
Well, she was pretty thoroughly blacklisted. I think that was because she was the original cause celeb. That happened in late August. The Red Channels came out in June. Not much happened at first, but then there was an uproar about her appearance on The Aldrich Family, and she was fired from the show immediately, and the producers immediately panicked. In this case, it was NBC. So she was out of it for a long time. She had other problems, too, I think health problems and so forth, so that might have aggravated it. But, you know, it could be, in some cases, kind of porous, because it depended, once again, on how the producers wanted to do it. There was a show called Danger, which is a famous example. It was produced by a man named Charles Russell. And if you've seen the movie The Front, the Woody Allen movie, that's what this is really about. That was written by Walter Bernstein, who was blacklisted, or at least officially blacklisted. But he used to write for that show along with a couple other people who appeared to have been communists, and they were able to get fronts. In this case, people who would put their names to their scripts. So they were able to continue to work during that period. And once again, there wasn't much that could be done about it.
Did any of these actors, actresses, writers, were they ever able to get back in the business years down the line?
I think most of them were. You know, people like Lee Grant and John Randolph. By the time the 60s came along, they were able to get back into it. And other people, oh, an example, Zero Mostel, it was a little bit ironic in a way. In a strange way, he sort of profited from the blacklist because at the time it happened, he was an obscure bit player in movies who didn't seem to be going anywhere. He was forced to get out of movies, also radio and television, and he went into nightclubs and cabaret. And eventually that led to Broadway, where he finally became a star. It didn't exactly work out perhaps how he planned it, but that's the way it went.
I'm Amy Eddings, sitting in today for Leonard Lopate, and I'm speaking with David Everett. He's the author of A Shadow of Red, Communism and the Blacklist in Radio and Television. What was significant about Kenneth Bearley's resignation from Red Channels?
Well, he was the researcher, the one who was involved in that part of the operations, and he was always considered to be the most methodical one and the most careful one. And he broke with the group because he said he thought they weren't being careful with the allegations that they were making.
How long had Red Channels been publishing by this time when he got uncomfortable with it?
It was only a year or two after it that he became that uncomfortable that he decided to quit. And he was interviewed at the time, and he said it was being used improperly and that there were people who were being victimized who really weren't communists. He still believed in the idea that you had a guard against having communists on the air, but he didn't agree with the way it was going about.
And what way would he have preferred?
Well, he would have been just much more thorough about it. And also, it's based upon interviews that he gave. He wasn't necessarily interested in getting these people off the air. He suggested at one point what was wrong is that certain communist sympathizers were getting on the air and presenting themselves as liberals, and it was really perpetuating a fraud on the public. He said that at least the people should know who these people are and what their background is so they could evaluate it from there.
What did he go on to do?
Well, he became a private consultant, continuing to do, well, actually, in some cases, getting people's careers back on track. The most famous example was Judy Holliday, who was hired by Columbia Pictures to evaluate her background. And what he came up with is that, you know, there really wasn't anything to be alarmed about. So he was still involved in the communist issue, but, you know, he was willing to get people exonerated if he felt that it was the proper thing to do.
Do you think his former partners saw any foreshadowing of him making a break and actually going on to help restore people's good names?
I'm not sure. I think, you know, another part of the problem was a personal clash. I think it was John Keenan, who could be very harsh and blunt and impulsive. And as one person who worked at Counterattack told me, Keenan was not the person to go to if you needed information about the Communist Party or about certain individuals, that Kenneth Bearley was the one. So I think it's something that probably grew over time.
How famous did these three men get themselves? Were they written about a lot? Did they appear on radio shows, TV shows, to talk about communism?
One of them became fairly well known. That was Theodore Kirkpatrick. He was essentially the front man for the group. And he, you know, he was a tall, handsome, ideally cast FBI man. And he was the one who would appear on radio and give speeches and sometimes appear on TV. And he was the public face for it.
You'd expect three frustrated ex-FBI agents to get involved in anti-communist efforts, especially if they had information in their FBI jobs that would lead them to believe that we've got to do something about this threat. But explain how Lawrence Johnson, a grocer in Syracuse, played such a prominent role.
Yeah, he's probably the most interesting one of the group. As you say, he was someone who owned six supermarkets in Syracuse. He's also 62 years old at the time he became involved. You would think he would be thinking about other things like retiring and taking it easy. But he had always been someone who'd really been immersed in the idea of Americanism. He was really, his whole career was based on this love affair he had with the old Crossroads Country Store. He had one, a facsimile of one, put into the corner of his flagship supermarket. And he had been involved in various patriotic activities. But what really turned the corner for him was during the Korean War. Once again, this is something that, you know, probably can't be said enough how important this was in getting people galvanized about this issue. His son-in-law, who had served in the Marines World War II, was called back to fight in Korea. And his daughter, who was married to this man, was actually the one that got started. She was the one who decided that she was really outraged by the fact that there were these communist fronters appearing on radio and in TV and being broadcast into her home, and she was buying products and other women were buying products for their families of that were made by the sponsors who were sponsoring these programs. And she was the one who started speaking in, you know, American Legion meetings and in Kiwanis clubs. And Lawrence Johnson became involved through her. And what's interesting is the way he was able to exert an influence. He claimed to have an influence first within the confines of Central New York. However much influence he had is debatable. But he also said
influence over fellow grocers,
yeah, other retailers.
Okay,
he was the one who provided.
Oh, so this is the connection to the sponsors,
right? He was the one who provided the. Should have mentioned this. He was the one who provided the economic leverage because he was the one selling products. He says, you know, what would happen if, you know, we would put up a sign above your product saying that this manufacturer employs Stalin's little creatures, as he liked to put it, meaning these communist fronters who appeared on their programs, which is something that did not please the sponsors too much and really scared off a lot of them. And he claimed that, you know, he had influence amongst other stores in Central New York, but also throughout the country.
Did he?
This is something that's very debatable. I question. I don't think he did. I think the main point is that it was never tested. No one bothered to call his bluff. I think the only time you really saw this, which I think is interesting, is by people who knew him the best, meaning broadcasters in Syracuse. They were receiving some pressure from him. There was a station who was playing a lot of Artie Shaw records. He was someone who was listed in Red Channels, also another station, I think, was playing Weaver's records, which was always something you shouldn't do as far as Larry Johnson or the other people were concerned. So they were under the gun. But what they decided to do was to get together for a meeting at Syracuse University to discuss how they should respond to this problem that they were facing. And their response was basically to tell Johnson to take a hike. They weren't going to allow him to pressure them into doing something. And what's very interesting is that nothing happened. Hmm. There was no consequences for them. And he actually had some real leverage with them because he was buying airtime to advertise his stores. So they were, you know, facing the possibility of losing some revenue.
But he didn't do that.
It never happened. He was never able to exert influence. But here you have these major corporations, not all of them, but some of them who caved in immediately. And there's an interesting comment from one of the Syracuse broadcasters talking about the New York broadcasters, wondering why they were acting the way they were as far as Larry Johnson was concerned. He said, they must be so big, they're stupid.
How did the blacklist affect how TV and radio newsrooms covered the anti-Red Crusade and the Soviet Union?
Well, as far as how they covered the anti-Red Crusade in broadcasting, they didn't cover it at all, as far as I know. I think if you're talking about TV news, I think that's true. There was a lot of talk about it in newspapers and so forth. It wasn't a case of, you know, the people being silenced by it. But in TV news, this is something else that I think really had a lot to do with the way things happen. Is they the networks really did have a weapon in their arsenal. They, you know, they had this electronic bully pulpit. They could have put together perhaps investigative reports or exposés about what was happening as far as the black was, excuse me, as far as the blacklist was concerned. And this wasn't done. Edward R. Murrow, you know, he's gotten a lot of credit for the exposés he did about Senator McCarthy, and he deserves some credit for that. But you have to wonder why he didn't do anything about what was happening in his own backyard. I think this probably could have made a big difference.
You provided us with an example of how the blacklist affected radio and TV entertainment. Let's hear from the radio melodrama, I Was a Communist Spy for the FBI.
I was a communist for the FBI. Starring Dana Andrews and an exciting tale of danger and espionage. I was a communist for the FBI. Many of the incidents in the story you're about to hear are based on the actual records and authentic experiences of Matt Savetic, who for 9 fantastic years lived as a communist for the FBI. Here is our star, Dana Andrews, as Matt Savetic.
There is no peace, there is no security, there is no hope for those who live in the chains of communism. Those misguided fools who, for one reason or another, have chosen to sleep in the red bed don't realize, until too late, that they can know no rest. They're worshippers in a strange religion, a religion in which their savior, the Communist Party, crucifies humanity to save itself.
Okay, besides completely over the top, how would you describe this show?
What do you think they were trying to say?
Oh,
there?
Their message is lost on me. Wow.
Well, that was an
pretty
example.
Heavy hitting stuff.
Yeah, that was an example. Well, they just don't make them like they used to. Well, that was an example of one thing that happened in the broadcast medium. This was a radio show at the time. It was based on a true story of something that happened, although the stories in the show weren't necessarily true. The excerpt speaks for itself, incredibly alarmist. And the same producers then went a few years later, did a TV show also based upon the experiences of someone who infiltrated the Communist Party. This one was called I Led Three Lives, which is probably even more of a hit. And the same sort of attitude. It was the main character is played by Richard Carlson. The book itself is actually not very sensational. It's really a fairly sober look at what went on in the Communist Party, policy changes, and so forth. Nothing like that in the show. The Richard Carlson, you just couldn't walk down a street even at midday without, you know, looking over his shoulder in a cold sweat. There was always, you know, the prospect of, you know, commie goons about to snuff him. So this was something that was going on. It was obviously the biggest manifestation of that attitude on the airwaves.
Now, were these handful of men behind Counterattack and Red Channels instrumental in getting these kind of melodramas produced? Did they actually pressure TV and radio broadcasters to make this kind of stuff? Or did this just emerge out of the zeitgeist of what was going on, the Korean War and the Cold War?
I think it was just the, you know, the ideological climate at the time. And, you know, I think it also should be pointed out, as nuts as that excerpt might have sounded to people today, it wasn't anything particularly different between that and the sort of shows that were being done during World War II. It really wasn't an aberration. You know, you can hear shows like Counter Spy from that period. It's really the same sort of thing. And, you know, in times of war at that time, this is what you would hear.
John Henry Falk was on the other end of the spectrum. He had a radio show in Texas. Sounds like he was a 1950s version of Molly Ivins, liberal, funny, irreverent. What was his show like? What would he talk about?
Well, it was he was really a raconteur. He was known as a professional Texan, and he would do a lot of anecdotes. The liberal philosophy that he had really wasn't that apparent. He was really soft-pedaling that at the time. But what happened is he became... he was elected as vice president of AFTRA, the Actors Union, and it was there and it came to the attention of the Red Hunters, and they put out a newsletter called Aware, and it was put out by Aware Incorporated, and they cited various Communist Front associations that he had. And a year and a half later, he was blacklisted. Unlike other people, he decided to do something about it, and he hired Louis Neiser, the celebrated attorney, and they went to court and took the Red Hunters to court in a libel case, which ended being a very historic case because he won an award of $3.5 million, which was the highest award for a case like that up until that point.
And it basically ended the blacklist.
That's right. It had been starting to fade in the previous 5 years or so, but once that happened, it was really all over.
Well, that's all the time we have. Thank you so much. I've been speaking with David Everett. He's the author of A Shadow of Red, Communism and the Blacklist in Radio and Television, published by Ivan R.D. Thank you so much for coming to the Leonard Lopate Show.
Well, thank you for having me.